Dodie, what comes to mind when I say drugging the undruggable?
Oh gosh, I'm not sure, but it's definitely not suitable for work.
Well, it's not quite teenagers misbehaving. It's drugging undruggable targets with candidates. And this is a concept in drug discovery and development. But first, I think we probably need to get some grounding in key terms that will make it easier for listeners.
And for me.
Because I found it really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tough set of concepts. So imagine you're creating the world's best key, and the target is the lock that you're trying to open. In drug discovery, the lock is usually a protein in the body that plays a role in disease. Maybe it's causing cells to grow and divide too rapidly in cancer, or it just isn't doing its job properly in Alzheimer's, for example. So researchers try and design a key that fits perfectly into this lock, to open it or close it and change its activity to treat the disease.
Okay, I'm with you. I'm with you.
So that's the target and the lock, right? So the candidate in drug discovery is like the key that we think might fit that lock. So it's a medicine that's shown promise in early testing. It seems to fit the lock and turn it in the right way. But we need to do more testing to make sure it's safe and effective. So it's got to be able to get the lock into the body without causing harm.
Okay, well, now that's a good foundation.
It's quite magical in a way. And the task of drugging the undruggable is trying to pick that lock without a set of lock-picking tools. And the scientists need to get creative. So they design a special key that can change shape, or they devise an entirely new method to unlock the lock without a traditional key.
Right. We're now like janitors. We have a whole bunch of keys on our keychain, and let's talk about drugging the undruggable, because that's what matters today on Discovery Matters.
It's exactly right. Jingle jangle, here come the keys. So to guide us through this, we're going to talk to Mark.
My name is Mark Bray. I am a second year PhD student in the Bowman Lab at the University of Pennsylvania, where I combine experimental and computational structural biology tools towards protein design.
So back to the keys and locks, Mark's working on making better keys for locks that might be proteins or nucleic acids, for example.
The term drugging the undruggable, quote unquote, refers to molecular targets. And like you said, this can be proteins, RNA, DNA, that are known drivers of disease, but are difficult to target with currently available technologies or drugs. So examining the history of drug development, we can appreciate that advances in medical research have enabled us to drug molecular targets that were previously considered quote unquote undruggable. And this in turn has expanded the clinical options available both to patients and to their clinicians to help treat a variety of diseases.
And this means there are clear criteria that make a target druggable.
Proteins do the bulk of the work in cells and in your body. If we're looking to drug a protein target, we're looking for it to have a deep pocket within the protein where, let's say, we can design a small molecule to bind and stay. And then after binding, either activate a function or inhibit some function that the protein is responsible for. And that, we hope, will have some consequences on the disease that we're hoping to treat. Another thing we think about in addition to deep pockets is, can we design a peptide or some other molecule to disrupt the binding interface between multiple targets, whether it's two proteins or a protein interacting with an RNA?
When something is considered undruggable, how do you go about initially identifying something that will drug it? So how do you design that key if the lock is so complex?
So it's about understanding the disease process and the structures of the proteins that cause it, the shape of the lock.
Do we understand the disease pathology enough to identify the exact cause or exact causes of the disease? And so oftentimes, That is a bottleneck, not understanding the disease pathology to a sufficient degree. And the second, after identifying a target, is does it have those deep pockets, or does it instead have shallow pockets or just large interaction surfaces with their intracellular partners, such that it's difficult to design something with a high specificity toward that site? Another thing that can make a molecular target, such as a protein, undruggable or difficult to target is if the active site or other site that you're looking to target is shared with other proteins in the cell. You want to design a drug for a target, but you also want to avoid off-target effects.
So you want to be sure your key only opens the locks that you want it to, so no access to other doors. This is not a master key. This is that unique door key.
Exactly.
So what previously undruggable targets stand out that people were working on for a long time and then suddenly they found a way of drugging them?
Some of the clinically validated drivers of cancer come to mind. One that comes to mind are kinases, which are a family of enzymes that add a phosphate group to other proteins in the cell. And so in a normal cell, the addition of these phosphate groups to particular proteins elicits the downstream signals that they result in cell growth and proliferation. Now, when these, in normal cells, when this is controlled, it's a good thing. But when they become unregulated, the cells begin to grow abnormally and you can have those cells become cancerous. We've made a lot of progress in developing inhibitors for some kinases, again, owing to their having those pockets or interaction surfaces that can be targeted. For other kinases, they lack those pockets or they share functional sites with other proteins inside of the cell such that they're difficult to target without having off-target effects that would be detrimental to the patient.
So this brings us to the structure of the research. Is it better to pick a particular target and try to find ways of drugging it?
Or do you look at mechanisms that maybe allow you to approach a whole swath of similarly characterized undruggable targets? So coming back to that master key, a skeleton key for the lock.
Having the technology in place that can be used in identifying the targets responsible for causing disease. And once you have that, identifying either a small molecule or a biologic that you can develop to specifically target that molecule. The recent advent of CRISPR gene editing has allowed us to specifically identify molecular targets that are driving a disease phenotype through screens, and we're able to combine these insights from genetic screens with advancements in structural biology and to develop a better conceptual framework for how the drug can be rationally designed. So we know what target is causing a disease, we know what the target looks like, how it interacts with its intracellular partners, and we can start to screen either small molecules or design biologics that would be able to interrupt that interaction between those molecules or a small molecule that will bind specifically to that target and inhibit its activity.
So you want to be able to try lots and lots of configurations of keys for these difficult locks. Is there a role for machine learning?
Absolutely.
I currently am designing peptides to inhibit an Ebola virus protein. And so some tools that I use are machine learning based tools to design the peptides. And then I run molecular dynamics simulations with those peptides bound to the complex to not just assess how the peptide behaves when bound to the protein, but does it fly off? Does it stay bound to the protein? What does its structure look like? And does it complement the site that we're looking to target? I'm interested in the application of those structural-based insights to any disease that we can treat. With viral targets, it's very top of mind because COVID was not too long ago, and that was a period where, you know, suddenly the whole world was looking for a solution, and we couldn't wait for it. It wasn't the traditional drug development process where it could take 10 to 15 years. We needed something instantly. The ability to go from structural insights to inform a design and testing protocol that actually works, something that's really appealing to me.
What drew Mark into this field?
As with so many things, it just begins with being curious about the world. So, like all good scientists, that's where Mark started.
Toward the end of high school and college, that I started to get into the field of research, starting with biomedical engineering research, and found that I really enjoyed the process of asking questions, learning how to ask good questions, and then not only finding out, but applying novel methods to find out what those answers are. When the COVID pandemic was raging on, something that I saw going on around me and I thought about a lot was, how can we, as a country, as a society, how can we better respond to these challenges that I think we'll continue to face in the coming years? And I think we've learned a lot from COVID, and hopefully our responses continue to improve.
But this field involves dedication and patience and a willingness to really think differently.
If you're naturally driven to ask questions and to find out answers to those questions, this is a very fulfilling path, potentially. And it takes a lot of persistence, a lot of dedication, and just being able to think creatively, not giving up at the first roadblock, but being able to persevere through challenges that come up.
You need to get used to failing, failing more and failing often, right? Failure is progress in this field.
Oh my goodness. And this reminds me, Connor, of the gift that you gave me for Christmas, which is the book about failing, why learning to fail can teach us to thrive. So I can't help but agree, every day is a school day, and failure can actually help you find something to motivate you in your work. But what about what Mark says? Which aspect of his work really lights his fire?
We've designed these peptides that we think will bind and we think they'll do well in in vitro assay. So I'm quickly getting to the point where I can actually test the proteins. I'm actually purifying the viral protein I'm working with right now, and really excited to actually test the peptides in the coming weeks. If it doesn't look good, thinking about what are the next steps? Why didn't it work? Can we design them to be better? And testing them again. I'm testing one viral protein. It's a protein that's essential for the viral replication cycle. We think if we can, without this protein's activity, the body can have enough time to mount its own immune response. And so if you can design a peptide that kind of slows down that process just long enough for your body to do what it does best, which is defends us every day against a whole host of foreign invaders, we can have potentially a treatment for Ebola.
So Mark's working on the keys to Ebola and really enjoying his time in the lab. What happens when these candidate drugs make it towards the clinic? Let's speak to somebody who's taking a really unusual approach and making it happen in biotech, in the real world. So most drugs are keys that unlock and interfere with proteins that cause disease. But some keys unlock proteins that are suppressed in disease and then augment them.
I am Vicky Rashan, and I'm CEO at Intact Bio, and I've scientifically trained and now been much more on the business side by being the CEO. It was really my passion for drug discovery that led me to be able to tackle really hard problems and new types of disease. And I've spent my career really inhibiting targets that are overactive in disease. But now that we've learned so much about disease, there are thousands of proteins that are actually underexpressed in disease that actually cause disease as well. But what we haven't had is approaches to be able to increase those proteins, enhance those protein activity, other than very few approaches, agonism, where there's small molecules that agonize, but we really haven't figured out how to make that routine and how to have that be a process of drug discovery. And so that has led me now to Intact, where we're working to really have a potential new modality to enhance protein function for those, as we've now understood, those diseases that are caused by the underexpression or of a specific protein.
Why is inhibition the primary approach in most drug discovery instead of enhancement?
From a drug discovery sense, when you're inhibiting something, you're inhibiting an enzyme. Right? You're able to go in and understand the enzymatic reaction and the substrate for that enzyme or cofactors. One of the advances that's happened is really now that you can have induced proximity, right? And so PROTACs, but where you can go in now and degrade the whole protein. So in that case, you have a molecule that targets the protein of interest, brings the E3 ligase, which is an enzyme that adds a ubiquitin that is a signal for degradation. So what we're doing is just the opposite of that, right? Because what we're doing now is bringing a deubiquitinase targeted to a specific protein and using nature's way of regulating protein function and removing the ubiquitin and then giving the more protein time to accumulate now. And so you're decreasing that balance of making the protein and destroying the protein.
With these layers of complexity, how does Vicky's team work differently to those who are focused on inhibition?
Well, one way is to learn from the technology around us.
One of the things that I'm really proud that we've been able to build the tools and capabilities to be able to do drug discovery in this area with our Encompass platform. Many of the tools that we've been using, such as CRISPR, where you can actually say, I'm going to knock down any gene in our genome to see what is overexpressed, that leads to a loss of cell viability. It's been much more difficult to actually identify on the other side because there's now CRISPR-I, which is the inhibition, and CRISPR-A, which is the activation. So people are now starting to do activation screens to say, what is that you overexpress that you can also see the inhibition of cancer cell growth? But most results have actually focused on knockout screens, SI screens, CRISPR screens, and looking for something that's overexpressed that we can inhibit. So it's not only the ability to do drug discovery and find inhibitors, but it's also that we've been focusing our targets on overexpression versus underexpression in terms of driving disease.
So coming back to the topic of today's episode, locks and keys, this approach enables an increased focus on keys for undruggable targets.
Cystic fibrosis has become a disease now where there were no treatments early on. And Vertex has done an amazing job in being able to show that a small molecule can change the folding and activity of that protein to now make real strides in the treatment of cystic fibrosis, which again is a loss of function. So you can imagine all of these genetic monogenic diseases where you have a loss of function of that protein, that we now have an approach that's very systematic. We can recruit to this protein and be able to increase that protein function and have an opportunity to treat that disease. To maybe think about it is really about pathways and pathway biology, where again, we've been inhibiting pathways, but there are multiple ways to inhibit pathways that are overactive in disease. We are really have to start really showing by example these approaches that we've been taking to really open our minds up to think about agonism as an approach rather than enhancing protein function as approach to treating disease. Number one, where there's clear, this one gene is down, has been impacted, it's lower in disease, and that's causing the disease. We have a way now to treat that with this approach. And then more complex diseases as well.
So a new modality that works differently to those that we've had before does not come around too often, despite all of the innovation that we've seen in the past 3 or 4 years.
So that brings new challenges. How do you explain the new modality to investors and regulators and clinicians and prove that the approach is credible?
Not to mention patients. How do you explain that to patients?
Indeed.
Well, I think with anything new, any new technology, there's also always a spectrum of response where there's excitement, but you need to show proof of concept, right? There's a lot of interest in pharma with induced proximity. And most pharma now have compounds in their pipeline that are on the PROTAC degrader side and are really excited about this next generation. So from there, I think there's just been excitement about what induced proximity can do. Showing the results we've built so far with our Encompass platform has really gotten a lot of interest. I think from a regulatory perspective, it's going to be very interesting. I think the PROTACs are having their first pivotal study, and it's going to read out, I think, very soon and file their NDA. So to have approved drugs leading the path for these types of molecules, we'll learn what intacts do. But there are agonists that are out there as well. So we'll learn from agonists as well as from the biology side in terms of what's required from gene therapy. We have models that we'll take from in terms of learning from a regulatory perspective the movement of these molecules forward. But I think clearly with the first PROTACs going into the approval, it's a really exciting time for induced proximity.
When she looks into the future of this modality, what questions is Vicky asking and what advances does she anticipate?
How can you make our drugs more precise to the target of interest? What are those technologies where we can really precisely target that protein that's disease causing or other molecules that are disease causing and really be able to move them forward? I think that certainly machine learning and incorporating machine learning into everything that we're doing has just seen huge strides. We're going to see things beyond what we ever envisioned. You know, I think induced proximity is one of those areas that's brand new, that's just taking hold. I'm really excited about bringing a new modality that changes the way we think about target space and expands our druggable universe.
So there it is, locks, keys, drugging the undruggable, the challenge of making new drugs to treat diseases and where those diseases, you know, work with difficult targets. It's how progress is made, understanding the mechanism of disease and then targeting those diseases or those disease mechanisms with candidates. It's essentially the therapeutic development process.
I think it's been interesting to hear about flipping the approach.
Yeah.
Right, from inhibiting proteins to how do you encourage proteins to develop and help our bodies take care of themselves. I just think that's, yeah.
Exactly. It's a really neat little way of like turning the problem upside down and coming at it from a different point of view, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Let's talk about every day being a school day, Connor, and get to some interesting things that we learned in recent history.
Every day is a school day, Dodi. What have you learned this week?
Oh, well, speaking of books that were gifts, our colleague Donald Phipps gave me a book called The Golden Thread, How Fabric Changed History. And being an avid sewist, I loved every minute and every page of this book.
Is that a thing? Sewist?
Yes.
Is sewist
a
thing?
Absolutely. Okay. I'm a sewist, so I hoard fabric. Check it out on Instagram. It's a lot of fun. But that's not what I learned this week because that's my everyday life. What I learned from this book relates to biology. And there are some researchers who are looking into spiders' webs and making that a material that we can use inside our bodies to help repair injuries or ligaments or, you know, spider's web material is not rejected by our bodies. So this is a course of research for curing inside our bodies. It's completely fascinating. Not a lot of progress because you can't get to scale with the spider's web. So they're looking at how can we synthetically create something that is like that spider's web.
We don't have lots of teeny weeny spiders that get to live inside
like
us, which are injecting
what?
Little teeny weeny. I would like that, you know.
You would. That would be very microbiome-y.
Yeah, we could have these guys. They could be sewing stuff inside, and I think that would be cool. No, but obviously, you know, not the right approach.
I totally recommend though The Golden Thread: How Fabric Changed History.
So here's something that's just spectacularly exciting, and it shows us the progress that we are making in treating diseases that are just really have been prevalent for years. Do you remember the launch of the HPV, the human papillomavirus vaccine, right? So a study in Scotland has found, guess how many cases of cervical cancer among women who were vaccinated before the age of 14? Guess how many?
I'm going to guess 000. Because it's really good news.
Absolutely awesome. Zero. It's incredible. So Scotland has detected no cases of cervical cancer amongst the women born between 88 and 96 who were fully vaccinated against HPV between the ages of 12 and 13. This is
beautiful.
Just a huge impact on child health, on women's health, and on the impact on the healthcare system as a whole. So it's just super exciting. It's great news. Shows that the vaccine is really effective. So there you go.
Congratulations to those teams and congratulations to the women of Scotland. That's really good news to end this episode on. Our producer is Beth Armit Brewster, editing, mixing, supervision by Banda Productions, music from Epidemic Sound. My name, as always, is Dodie Axelson.
And I'm Connor McKechnie. Make sure you rate us on Spotify or whichever platform brings our dulcet tones to you. We'll see you when we come back with another episode of Discovery Matters.